Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from The Grave Talks. If you're liking this program, I invite you to become a grave keeper. That is a supporter of this program. You are the folks who will financially allow this show to continue going forward. $5 a month gets you access to advanced episodes of the show as I create them. Typically 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes even more episodes in advance, available exclusively for our Grave Keeper members. Plus, exclusive interview segments that are not going to be available to the public, only to gravekeepers. Typically an extra 10, 15, 20 minutes of interview time with future guests of our show going forward. It's exclusive content, it's advanced content, and it's only for gravekeepers who are helping to keep the show on the air. It takes a tremendous amount of time every single week for me to put this show together, get it up, get it on the air, have it hosted, bandwidth, all of that. And I love doing it, but we do need to make sure it's financially viable, and at least to support the costs of running this thing. So if you like the show, please consider becoming a gravekeeper through our website, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month, get advanced access and exclusive content as well to keep this show on the air. Thank you for your support. I hope you enjoy it just as much as I do. Check it out, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. And thank you for your support. Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted Big Sur Lighthouse. Originally commissioned in 1889, the Big Sur Lighthouse has been a beacon for those coming off the ocean in peace and a final sign of life, as many lives were swept up by the ocean as their ships went down. Not only has what is now known as the haunted Big Sur Lighthouse been a structure by the sea, it has been home to many families employed to watch the building and to keep its lights shining bright. Many of the families who called the haunted Big Sur Lighthouse home lasted less than 1 year before calling it quits. Maybe it was the isolation of living in such tight quarters that drove them out. It could have been the constant anxiety that they felt watching ships come in and many go down. Either way, emotions ran high in the Big Sur Lighthouse for many generations. Does the energy that these families felt still echo through the halls of Big Sur today? Or do their spirits intelligently run the lighthouse from the other side? It's questions like these that we have answered in today's episode of The Grave Talks, as we talk with Julie Nunes about the ghosts of Big Sur.
Well, the lighthouse came to be because in 1948, the amount of ships that used to cross by it was maybe 102. And then in 48, it went to almost 1,000 because of the gold rush. All the 49ers were coming out looking for gold in California. That's when we started getting the shipwrecks and everything. So construction began in 1887. and it was completed in August 1st, 1889, the first time it was lit. And back then, it cost three payments that added up to about $110,000, which equals about $2.1 million in today's dollars.
Now, this lighthouse, obviously, it's out there. It's a beacon. A lot of shipwrecks out in that area. This lighthouse was probably one of the last lights many people on the sea saw before, I mean, not to go too morbid, but before they passed, before their ships went down. It was kind of it was probably also one of the most welcoming things to see if they did make it into shore, correct?
Yes, because where this lighthouse is are probably the strongest currents and winds of all Monterey County. So it's the most dangerous part of the seashore anywhere along the coast of Monterey area to Big Sur.
In its life, as a lighthouse, in its prime and all of that, what was life like with the lighthouse? How was it manned? What was going on with it? What are some of its stories?
So this was actually considered, it's more called a light station. Lighthouses are usually one building with a lighthouse attached to it. We're a rarity. We're a light station. We have about eight buildings, and we're one of the rarest lighthouses. Once we get our Fresnel lens back in within a year, which you're going to be excited, we're going to be the only complete lighthouse in the United States with all our light station with all the buildings intact. So back then, it was pretty desolate and isolated. It took 4 hours from Monterey by horseback to get to and from the lighthouse one way. So if there were any shipwrecks, it took the doctor 4 hours to get there to help any of the people that might have washed ashore around the lighthouse, which happened a bit. There were some major shipwrecks, one being the Los Angeles, where about 12 people passed away. Only six passengers were lost out of 49, but that was considered a lot back then, considering that there was only, so that's about, an eighth of the passengers that they lost, which is a great amount if you think of it that way.
Sure.
So even to get school teachers out there, usually right out of school, the college for teaching, they didn't last more than maybe 6 months. Their only social part would have been with people in Big Sur or on the lighthouse at Point Sur. And most of those, there was usually about three, one head keeper and three assistants. So up to maybe four families, unless one of the keepers was not married at the time. So basically had no social life. And most of the families didn't last but 6 months out there. And during the rainy season, it could become an island. It's about 300 feet up. It's kind of like this Morro rock. And so it was pretty hard, and they actually even gave $200 more a year. Usually lighthouse keepers got $600. Whoever went there got $800 a year because of the desolation out there and how far they were removed from everything and everybody.
What were the type of person that would become a lighthouse keeper? Who would become a lighthouse keeper, and why? What sort of qualifications would they have to have?
A lot of times it was gentlemen from past military, like Navy. There were several that were from the Swedish Navy that would come out there. I don't think there was, I think basically just to know some navigational things and about ships and stuff like that was the only, I think that would have been the only qualification. There wasn't anything that I know of in particular, but it seemed like a lot of them were ex-Navy people.
And probably a desire or a comfort with being isolated or being alone. That would, I would think, have to be part of the disposition of someone who would want to go to such a remote area and be by themselves.
Well, if you've never been out there, so I wouldn't say that because it's my Shangri-La out there. It is stunningly beautiful, and to this day, it's as quiet as it would have been in the late 1800s. You don't hear the freeway that's a quarter of a mile away, any of the cars. It's rare that a plane or a helicopter goes over us. So basically, it's the wind, the oceans, the sea lions that you hear. And I could see the beauty of being by the ocean. And maybe once they got there, then maybe the isolation got to them. But Big Sur was only maybe by car 10 minutes away. So let's see, by horse, what would that be? Like a half hour?
Sure.
Something like that. And so they did some trading and, you know, socializing with them and trading for, let's say, we had a blacksmith shop, and the blacksmith shop would, you know, do things for them or make things for them, and they would get supplies that they might not get the four times a year. They got supplies, maybe like milk, fresh milk, and things like that of such. And Monterey Jack cheese, which was invented in Big Sur.
And I don't say being in isolation and disposition as a negative thing. I would enjoy it myself. I enjoy being away from people. I'm just thinking of I guess, a majority of the population wouldn't fare well being that far away from others.
Yeah, and that is true, as I said before, is because of a lot of them didn't last more than 6 months to a year out there. So, yeah.
Did they have contracts of, you need to stay here X amount of time? Were they leaving before they were expected to leave? How did that all work?
I believe there weren't any. I've never heard of any contracts.
Okay.
At all. So I think they were just glad to have people out there. So whatever it took to get them out there, like I said, 200 more a year back in the late 1800s is a ton of money to people back then.
What was life like when they were there, when a disaster would occur, when there would be a shipwreck? Walk me through that. Let's say they're out there, they realize there's a wreck going on. What resources do they have to help the people that were in distress out at sea, or did they just wait for them to come in? Tell me how that worked.
So they must have had some system with, they would go into Big Sur and get people in them, and people would get their fishing boats and go out to help the people, and some and try their best, not being any doctors nearby, to save them or keep them alive till the doctor could get there. But basically, it was the fishermen who helped with any of the wrecks. It was really dangerous because it's some of the best kelp beds in all of California, and right next to the lighthouse is a habitat to keep otters being prolific. They were like, you know, we're up to about probably 1,500 otters now because of the area with the kelp beds. But with kelp, there's rocks. Kelp is attached to rocks, and there's tons of rock formations, and that's what caused some of the shipwrecks. They would get too close and get stuck on the rocks, or, you know, just the currents would just throw them into dangerous areas, or some mistakes in the past with shipwrecks. The captain wasn't steering the ship, and it was the assistant who might have had, in one case, too much to drink, or judged, he thought he was at this point along the coast, and he wasn't, and drove right into, you know, sailed right into dangerous waters with rocks. So basically, it was just a group of Big Sur people and Point Sur people getting together with their boats and going out there and risking their own lives because of the currents to help the people.
When the people were pulled from the wreckage, you know, obviously some would live, some would pass. Would those people, would their last destination essentially be oftentimes the lighthouse?
No, it would be on the shore along the beach. There was a barn on the base of the beach. So nobody has actually ever died on the rock where all the buildings are. at all. Nobody has. On the beach or in the barn, they were taken to the barn that used to exist at the base, and that's as close as they would get to the lighthouse.
Tell me about the life of the lighthouse and its activity. How long was it an active lighthouse where folks were living there and manning this thing year-round?
I would say the last people there were the Coast Guard, and that was about the mid-70s when they decided it was pretty much automated and they didn't need anybody out there. Yeah, and since then, and we used to have a first order Fresnel lens, which is the biggest Fresnel lens, 6 feet in diameter and 8 feet tall. And they had to take that away because people were shooting at it and stealing parts once it became where nobody was living there anymore. So we're so happy we're getting it back this year. Oh, it's going to be gorgeous. It's going to be beautiful.
What was the first account that anyone had of there being anything amiss, anything paranormal going on with the lighthouse? Take me back to that. Was it the Coast Guard? Was it individuals living there? Was it after all of this? What were some of those first accounts?
Well, you know what? No, I was my best friend and I were the second people to ever investigate. So we're talking back in 2009 was the first time, and the other paranormal group just investigated maybe 2 weeks before we did. But before that, there was an article written about a year or two before that, that Point Sur was considered one of the top 10 most haunted lighthouses in the United States. And to this day, we don't know who investigated or how that story came about, because until then, there's maybe just one story about probably that happened in the 1980s when they started doing tours again. Some people got together and decided to save the lighthouse, and it was a small tour with maybe 6 to 8 people. I actually talked to one of the people who was on that tour a couple of years ago. And the Ranger, they just got out of the triplex, which was a building where 3 families lived. And the Ranger goes, okay, is everybody out? And the teenage girl, 16-year-old, said, no, there's the man still in there. He goes, what man? He goes, it's the man in the blue uniform with the hat, which was, and she said, blue uniform. And that was the color of lighthouse keeper, his uniform, his official uniform. So that was the first she saw a full body. She said she saw him, he looked at her, smiled, and she smiled back. And then, you know, okay, everybody, let's get out of the building. And that was the first account ever that we've been able to find about any paranormal activity. Basically there, if you're not looking for them, you would never know they're there.
Okay.
But if you're looking for them, they'll let you know. They might come out and say hi, and they literally do say hi or do things that make themselves known.
And I want to hear about your experiences investigating and some of the things that you found, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But based on knowing what you know now, what you've discovered, and like I said, we'll get in detail about that. That account of the girl seeing the man in blue, who do you think that it might have been? We're obviously the lighthouse keeper, but do you have any inclination of to who that may have appeared specifically in the terms of the life of the lighthouse?
There's several active that we've discovered keepers. So it could have been, last name was Ingersoll. He's active. More likely, his daughter is really active there. And also, oh shoot, what is the other guy? There was this other head keeper who likes playing cards, and we did something, was a study playing blackjack with him one day. But And the Owen family, they've some of the children have made themselves known out there. But I would say Ingersolls are a big part. And sometimes we put together who they are from their accents. One mother's talking to a daughter and calls her by her nickname, which I didn't know was her nickname till one of the living family members told me, no, that's saying Pokey. That's not saying what you thought it said. And that's her nickname. Her mom would call her Pokey. And she's the most active ghost out there. We've been able, let's see, we probably uncovered maybe 30 different voices and been able to identify 12 of them. So, but they've all worked there. I don't think there's anybody that hadn't lived up there at any time. There's no, like, wandering ghost that says, oh, this is a cool area, let's stay here. No, sure. Nothing like that.
What initially drew you to the lighthouse?
Well, my best friend Monica, she is the researcher, and they have moonlight tours during the better months out there. We have moonlight tours, and she says, let's go on a moonlight tour. This was supposed to be one of the top 10 haunted. So we brought our $30 Sony recorders, our K2 meter, still camera, and I think I had the Ovilus FX, which was the second Ovilus that came out, which, if your audience doesn't know, it's a machine made by Bill Chappell that has a dictionary of a couple of thousand words, and supposedly each word is a different frequency, and somehow the ghosts figure out how to talk to you using the frequencies. And sometimes I made my own dictionary, and mine's even more special. It comes out with words that shouldn't even be in the machine, and last names and stuff like that. That's how I was able to find out some last names. And the historian was there and said, yep, that's the last name of family. Yep, that's the last name of a family. And unusual names, not just, you know, typical names. And we got six class EVPs that evening. A little girl, there was no children on that tour. And it's like it was in the middle outside where we should have heard the wind or the ocean or the sea lions. That disappeared in the background. And they came out as clear as can be. One was like, go anybody here with me now? And a little girl goes, I'm right here. And then another one was a more a residual where it was Catherine Ingersoll, and she had a Danish accent, or we knew it was some Scandinavian country, and said, zoom, zoom, Pokey, go to bed. And then under Monica's voice, you hear Pokey go to bed, you know, kind of mimicking her mom. And then with the K2 meter, what was weird, it was outlining each of my other two friends, their bodies, only in the front. As they turned around, nothing but east, west, north, south, it would outline. And I said, well, what about me? Do, you know, try it on me. And the little girl's voice goes, we're working on it. it was pretty amazing. We did have one episode of Ghost Adventures out there, and they said they've never heard the quality of EVPs. And I had to send all those to them, and they tested them. They said, these are the real thing. But I think the reason Monica and I always get really great EVPs is because ghost hunting, which a lot of people don't realize, it has to do with manners. They are still alive in their minds, and we're alive in our minds. And if you say thank you and knock on the door, may I come and talk to you, they will just chat with you and be so happy with you. I'll bring flowers to the head keeper's house and sit in the kitchen, and like I'm having a conversation and with somebody that I don't hear, don't see, but I do get responses to my questions.
And that's half of, I think, what a lot of folks forget is that they're on the other side. And that seems to be, it's quite a concept to begin with. But somehow, I think sometimes we attach almost superpower abilities to them, or some sort of things that we would never assume a human would act like or feel like. And it's just like, they're there, we can't see them, let's treat them like they're, with respect, as if they're living. Yeah, and right there.
Definitely. Because I tested that theory out, not having a little respect, walking around the head keeper's house with a bottle of water. Because in those days, you only had food and beverage in the kitchen. You did not bring it to your bedroom, your living room. And I was told by one psychic that the lady of the house did not like that. And she let me know she didn't like that when I said, I'm walking around the house with a bottle of water. Some things happened where one of the paranormal things that happened at the beginnings when I investigated was we were upstairs maybe less than, probably 2 minutes. A docent was showing us the lay of the land of this one building. And when we came down after I had my bottle of water, it would be, it was during its restoration, and it was plaster and wood, the walls and ceilings, and some of the wood sticks that made up the wall. Three of the doorways, there were three sticks, a stick in each doorway, and they would be put perfectly left to right. If it was an inch and a quarter on the left, it was an inch and a quarter in the door jamb on the right. And if it was, you know, it was perfectly straight. So three of them were put in less, you know, in about 2 minutes to let me know that, no. And actually, they were keeping the doorway into the living room and both doorways into the kitchen. And that was one major thing that the docents would admit happened. Most of them wouldn't admit that anything paranormal happened there.
The first time that you walked in there, what was it, on an investigation? Was that the first visit with that moonlight tour?
It was a pseudo investigation because it was just a regular tour. We just happened to bring things, and the historian asked us what our equipment was, and she says, "Well, you know, if you get anything, let me know. Here's my email address, and send it to me, because this is part of history." And so we did, and she invited us back three more times. And on the fourth time, she says, "You know, if you become a docent, training starting next month, you come investigate here anytime you want." And that sold me right then and there. 3 months of classes and 3 months of passing tests. And 6 months later, I'm a docent, and I could go up there anytime to investigate.
Now, what is a docent exactly?
A docent basically is a person who gives a historic tour.
Okay.
So it's a tour guide. It's a fancy word, state park fancy word for tour guide, okay. Historical tour guide.
Okay. When you first walked in there on that tour, and before even you picked anything up and you discovered, hey, there's something going on here, what were you feeling? What did it feel like walking in there? Did you know right off the bat that this is a haunted place, considering there wasn't a whole lot of information about it other than a very large claim with very little evidence backing it up in that one article?
Yeah, you know what? I'm really good at sensing of, I could look at a building and say, yep, that's haunted, or blah, 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 blah. I don't know. That's kind of one of my, I guess, natural talents. But no, it's just, all you feel up there is you feel so, you're at peace when you're up there. And just the natural beauty of it just is so overwhelming. I usually have to babysit paranormal groups that I'm the one who babysits them when they come up to investigate. And they always said, the price of admission for the beauty of Point Sur is worth it all, even if we didn't see any ghost. You just get this sense of peacefulness, and there's nothing malevolent there. There's nothing, you know, evil. Mm-hmm. It's just happy, happy joy. Once in a while, you'll run into an assistant keeper or whatever who will say, get out, but we might be interrupting their sleep. Because my belief is in kind of quantum physics, past, present, and future are all happening at the same time, and there's something that makes them intersect. And that's what I believe when we get EVPs. It's whatever things make the different times and space come together. That's what happens. Because sometimes I've gotten EVPs where one was a woman's voice goes, "Can you hear me? Do you see me?" And so that makes it sound like she's hearing it while she's alive at real time, and we're hearing her voice. So many times, and I think a lot of investigators should remember this, they might hear our voices and they think they're going insane. So be sure to say what year it is. You're not going crazy. This is the year. It's 2018 or whatever year it is. You're not insane. I could hear you. And if you hear me, it's okay. We're in the future. Or who knows, maybe we're in the past and they're hearing us because of the quantum physics thing.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it, because it almost makes you wonder then if you're communicating to them in their time. And wouldn't it be amazing if somehow you came across a diary or some sort of writing of, "I was communicating with this woman from 2018, you know,
where that would be great.
Their account of interacting with you, that would be very, very amazing. And I could imagine, too, at that point in time, if they were having these experiences, it wouldn't have been spoken of. It would have been very, very hush-hush and very much kept to themselves if there was an interaction going on.
And that's true with me. When I first started investigating, I was, the other docents were laughing at me and stuff like that. Until we started raising money, and we don't get paid anything. Monica and I started doing 3-hour ghost investigations and charging a certain amount of money, and it was only like 12 people, and we let them use our equipment, and within a year we raised $7,000 and we became a wedge of the pie and the annual year-end account for where the monies came from. And then suddenly we weren't being laughed at as much, and then slowly but surely over the last 8 years, they've been talking about paranormal things. They could see it's more accepted, and some non-believers have become believers because recently, in the last year, one docent who was a non-believer saw 2 full body apparitions in the last year. So I've seen a partial, and Monica's seen a full body, but it's so different things. It's kind of interesting. Now I'm getting the stories, and then since having an episode on television about the lighthouse, we're getting more things sent to us of pictures taken while they're on the tour. It's some really interesting. A government agency was up there for a few nights, and what happened, what we could piece together happened to them. We can't. Oh, do you want to hear that story? That's pretty interesting.
I would like to hear that story.
So I won't say what government agency was up there and what they were doing up there. It was supposed to be all secret hush-hush.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposed to be there. We had a moonlight tour, and they weren't supposed to arrive till way after, like midnight. And they arrived at 10 o'clock. So they arrived in camouflage uniforms, guns strapped to their back, guns on their side, a beret, and all military looking, and so kind of scared some of the docents. What are you doing there? And they told us what they're doing there and what they're looking for. And then a week later, they're going to be up doing that for a week. A week later, the same docent sees one of them. She says, "How did you love being up here, our beautiful pointer?" He says, "We couldn't wait to leave every morning." She goes, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You must know this place is haunted." And she goes, "Well, I've heard it's haunted." He goes, "Well, from the time we arrived to the time we left, it was being known to us, no doubt, that we were not welcomed up there." And she said, "Well, like, what happened?" And he wasn't allowed, the CEO, I guess they talked to their CEO, and they were not allowed to say what happened. So we have no idea. I have an idea what they're capable of, but what I think happened was, because at one point during World War II, we had the Army and Navy out there looking for subs and airplanes, enemy subs and airplanes. And I think they thought they were being invaded by a foreign military force, because, you know, the modern uniforms look nothing what they looked like back then. Mm-hmm. There was no camouflage and stuff. And ever since then, now we have military spirits up there now, since that has happened. But it's scared all of them, and they're not allowed to talk about it. So we have no way to. We just know they the ghost kept them, you know, trying to chase them off and in whatever way they were doing, and scared them all.
Wow. I mean, I suppose it would be like, you know, if suddenly a military force comes and wants to hang out at your house for several days. It would be uncomfortable. And if you have the ability and they don't see you to try and scare them out, that's probably just exactly what they were doing. I mean, it's fairly simple to think about when you think about it in those terms, but that's probably how they were feeling. They were probably feeling threatened.
I have no idea. No doubt that's what they were feeling.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Julie Nunez about the haunted Big Sur Lighthouse. In part two, the Gravekeeper exclusive at patreon.com/thegravetalks, we continue talking about the ghosts of Big Sur and who were the full-body apparitions that were seen by staff of the lighthouse, and what did they do? Do the spirits interact with one another even if they're from different time periods? What was it like to play blackjack with a ghost? And what was it like seeing the full body apparitions for the first time? And how did the ovulus get words in it that were not programmed to come out of it? Those questions and more will be answered in part two of our interview with Julie Nunez about the Big Sur Lighthouse. To hear part two, become a Gravekeeper. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks or visit our website at thegravetalks.com. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Heat up your backyard with a new fire pit. Our fire pit bundle includes everything you need. Concrete landscape blocks, steel ring insert, pea gravel, and adhesive. All bundled together to make your project quick and easy. Visit us today in store or on Menards.com and save big on our full selection of fire pit projects and accessories today.